Hi, welcome back. We are the Bethel for Kingsgrave, an offshoot of an offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire. You are joining us here on episode 72 of the Epic Linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread. I'm your host today, Sarah, aka Lady Weaver, on the podcast of Ice and Fire Forums, and I am joined by Hannah.
Hey, it's Hannah, Shadow Baby on the forums.
Xander.
Hello, Xander, the Lord Baron on the forums.
Jock.
Mundo Jock here on the forums.
David.
Hi, David, David HHH on the forums.
And for his second ever episode, James.
Hello, woo! James, Queen James on the forums.
And woo! Special bonus, at least for a little bit, we have Adam.
Also known as Drown Snow on the forums. Under the sea, you know, people record and stuff. Ho ho.
Yes. Thank you, Adam.
I know.
Even in a cameo, he's funny.
Perfect. Okay, so in today's episode, we are covering the events from the 1st and 2nd of March 300. So that's Arya 1 of Feast for Crows, Tyrion 3 of Dance, and Sam 2 of Feast. This episode has spoilers for the A Song of Ice and Fire series by George R. R. Martin, including the Winds of Wind sample chapters, but not the HBO show A Game of Thrones. And all of the ideas presented are those of the individual and not of VOC as a whole. And unfortunately, we haven't succeeded in implementing our hive mind technology yet. But we will, don't worry. Now we're doing Arya 1, and the last time we saw Arya was back in A Storm of Swords, and that was actually on the 31st of January, so a month before this chapter, and this chapter takes place on the 1st of March. Okay, so take it away, Hannah.
Okay, we catch up with our wild and woolly Wolfette as she sails on the Titan's Daughter toward Braavos. She laments that she never ends up at her intended destination. Perhaps she should be trying to book passage to King's Landing, then maybe she'd end up at home. While the ship's crew and captain are respectful and for once not abusive to her, they still will not take her to the wall to seek out her sole surviving brother, John, and they don't really get too friendly with her either. Only the captain's son, Denyu, really shows much interest. We have some recapping of her storm storylines. Arya manages to acquire yet another alias, Salty, because they picked her up in Salt Pans, and picks up some bits of Braavosy. As they head toward the Titan of Braavos, the wolf girl recalls old Nan's stories of how the people of the anti-slave city feed the Titan high-born girls. She recalls that Sansa was stupidly intimidated by this anecdote. She asks the captain's son, Denyu, if the Titan is their god, and learns, rather, that all gods are worshipped there, but they are all superseded by the many-faced god. Arya rattles off her list, thinking that perhaps the many-faced god is the god who can answer her prayers. She has only 6 names left now. With Joffrey dead, she got the tickler herself, and she'd left the Hound for dead for sure. But she does give pause to the thought that it was merciless of her to leave him without giving him the gift of death. She beholds the colossal Titan and refuses to be afraid. When the ship slides into port, the captain bids her to take leave in a boat. He does not want her to stay while the customs officers crawl over the ship for upwards of half a day. She privately wishes to stay aboard, imagines life as Salty, the sailor girl, but she knows it's out of the question. The captain, Tenesiu Taharis, sends her away with Valar Dohaeris, and says she hopes she will remember him. Moving through the massive waterwayed city, she notes how magnificent Braavos is and how it dwarfs the glory of King's Landing. The captain's other son delivers her at the House of Black and White. She bangs frustratedly on the ebony and weirwood door. It does not budge until she shows her iron coin and it swings ghostily in. Once inside, she finds smells of home, pine, stew, mixed with the sounds of water. There are altars of all manner of gods. There's a man sitting beside a pool that is the centerpiece of Long Hall. He is trying to suck water from his fingers. She realizes he's thirsty and helps get him a cup of water. He looks at her and says, Valar Morghulis, and she replies, Valar Dohaeris. As he stumbles away to an alcove with a bed, she is shocked to see his belly bleeding from a stab wound. He goes to lie down and die, and she scans the room to see many people permanently sleeping. A black and white clad girl approaches her with an old man similarly robed. He questions her, what is your name? What is your quest? She tells about Jacques Nagar, and the name is not recognized. Even though she lies several times about her name, she is not thrown off any cliffs, but is forced to reveal her true name. The man pulls back his cowl, and his gross, decaying face is revealed. Arya, being brave and stubborn, is not repulsed, does not try to flee. She gives him the kiss he asks for and tries to eat the maggot crawling from his eyeless socket. He transforms into a beautiful enchantress and places a powerful spell upon the prince and the castle. Oh, no, wait. I'm sorry, that's a different fairy tale. He transforms into a very kind-looking old man. The kindly man is in impressed tones, laughs, and tells her that no one's ever tried to eat his worm before. She's passed the test. He asks, "Are you hungry?" And she replies, "Yes, but not for food."
Yep.
Wonderful, Hannah. Thank you. Do you have any points you'd like to start us off with?
One of my biggest just standout things that I'm not sure I ever really noticed before is the captain gesturing to her when they depart, and he's like, "I hope you'll remember me," and repeats his name to her. And then, of course, we learn later why, but I never for a second really connected the two until just now. And then just kind of had like meandering thought when they were still on the ship of, I wonder, since these people seem to be like decent folks that she's with, it just makes me wonder if they've ever like had any run-ins with Davos or know him maybe. And it's not something I think we need an answer to, but I just think it'd be cheeky. Like
with the captain, actually all of the sailors that speak to her tend to shower her with gifts and say their names to her until she repeats it back.
Right.
And the older captain's son does that as well when he drops her off at the House of Black and White.
Right. And I just, I never thought back on it. Even like all the rereading of this I've done, because I've never covered this chapter before, I don't think it ever really like dawned on me why they were doing that until just now. So I think that's, it's cool how some things don't show up really in your foreground of thought until you analyze them this way. I did have one other sort of psychological thing that came to my mind with her. It bothers me sometimes when everyone's saying like she's gone and become like a full psychopath, and I just don't think that about her. And I know it's a weird issue with her being so young and being a part of such a violent story arc, but it occurred to me that her being so young might be one of the reasons she's survived this long, because she's in that weird, you know, pre-tween age where everything's stupid. You know, like, oh, you're scared? That's stupid. I'm not going to be scared. That's stupid. And that attitude's kind of been a shield for her. It's been a bit of armor that has helped pull her through, where I think a softer person or someone, she's not stupid, but she's not smart enough to always be as cautious as she should be. But then she doesn't have fear with that. And I think that in some instances, it's definitely helped save her life.
Right.
And as well, with her age, if she was older, she would pose more of a threat. But because she is so young, people don't take her seriously.
Right. Like, look at her, how she gets really goes unnoticed, you know, in a lot of Harry situations.
And I mean, let's face it, if she hadn't gone on full-on psychopath, she definitely, what are the odds she would have survived all that she's been through? I mean, should she have gone as far as she did? Well, we can debate that. But, I mean, if she hadn't at least gone part way, she'd be dead by now. I mean, any normal child of her age would completely be dead right now.
And if she had been older and in some of the situations she was in surrounding Harrenhal, I think she would have been raped for sure, but perhaps not be quite butted helped her stay a little bit out of the, you know, eyesight of some predators.
Yeah, I mean,
younger, so she doesn't look, because you don't really start looking like either gender until you reach puberty, and because she hasn't reached it yet, she's boys and girls still look very, very similar. So that would help her, because a lot of the time she pretends to be a boy.
Right.
Well, and we know from people like Satin and stuff like that, that doesn't always save you, but it seems to be enough of a taboo in this culture that that's retained for brothels that cater to specific interests rather than would be openly accepted in the heat of the moment by a group of armed men. Which does not make either one right, but it does mean that it's sort of a saving grace for her.
When she says at the beginning that she's trying to, in her mind, pretend that she's heading home rather than to Braavos, and then she scolds herself for it, for being stupid, for thinking that, like, that's so sad. And her, like, trying to, God, I wish I could just, she tries to convince them to take them up to Eastwatch so that she can maybe get to John at the wall. It's like, oh, poor Arya.
Yeah. Well, like, she doesn't really think about her mom a lot, and she doesn't really think about her other brothers a lot, and anytime that she thinks about Sansa, she's scolding Sansa. She's like, Sansa's so stupid. And right. I feel like that's also a defense mechanism she's using, whether she knows it or not,
right,
to just be able to move on in a way.
Yeah. And as well, if she did think about her mom or her brothers that are dead, or a dad, like, a lot, and wasn't trying to move on from it, I think she'd dwell on it too much, and she might possibly sink into depression, or her grief would overwhelm her, and she wouldn't be able to function properly.
Right, she wouldn't be fighting, at least.
Yeah, whereas...
quick as she can.
Yeah, whereas if she doesn't think about it, at least, as much, and with Sansa, she might always think about her and mocks her bit, but is that so she doesn't try to find her, or is that because she's angry about Sansa and blames her for her dad's death, or is it just she's trying to survive and can't?
Yeah,
think about
I, that's
it.
What I think it is. I think it's like she can put Bran and Rick and more just away from her mind, and even her mom, because they've had distance. You know, like, she didn't see them for a long time before they were killed, and yeah, she was really young when they left. But she was with Sansa for a lot. She was with her dad for a lot, and I think it's probably she's shared a lot of the atrocities. She has Sansa as a co-victim, so she can't have them brought up in her mind without thinking of Sansa. But in order to not have that pain internalized, she's gotta put a wedge between her and Sansa. And it's like the best gift that Yoren ever gave her was that list, because instead of repeatedly dwelling on why she has the list, she just focuses all of it on the list itself. Mm-hmm. She never says the names and go, because you did this. It's right. Just the name.
Although you notice she's down to only 6 names left.
Yeah, but is her just dwelling on the names necessarily a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
Because
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a good or a bad thing. I just think it's like a natural manifestation of horrific, brutal trauma with no one to guide you through it, with no, she has no safety and no mooring from this storm of grief and guilt and terror. So I think it's just, you know, you can go 2 ways. You can shut up and you can, you know, lock emotions away, go catatonic. You can become more of a victim, or you can become part of the violence and control it.
Mm-hmm.
And Arya's personality just happens to be the latter.
Yeah.
And
none of it's healthy, certainly.
I would say, speaking of lists, one thing I was curious about here was when she takes the new name Salty, how many names is this for her? Like, is there any character in this show that said...
fifth.
Well, no, I actually looked it up. It's actually her 13th. If you count the little ones. So I looked it up in the Westeros wiki. Arya Horseface, Arya Underfoot, Arya...
nicknames,
but those
too?
Are nicknames, right.
I know.
But not
but,
actually
but even then, but
what
some of,
she
right,
goes
both,
by
right,
and
right.
characterizes herself under.
Right, but she had went Ari, Lumpy Head, Lumpy Face, Stick Boy, Rabbit Killer, Weasel, Nymeria, Nan, Squab, Wolf Girl, and now Salty. And there's still 5 more to come, and 1 in the Winds preview we won't talk about. But what I thought was interesting is at the end, she actually, at the end of the chapter, she actually goes by several of those names. She pulls them out, but of course, you know, the kindly man sees through it. But isn't it, she's had, I mean, has any character in the books had this many names?
According to Wiki of Ice and Fire, is actually 19.
Oh, well, yeah,
but
right,
has
right.
any other
well, no,
character
right,
been basically on the run since halfway through the first book?
Right, but I said, remember I said 13 so far, but there are 6 more, yes. Right, I pulled that from Wiki.
With every situation, she picks up a new name,
right,
and she also makes a new personality to fit that situation,
right,
which I honestly think she's already starting to lose herself.
Exactly.
Because earlier in this chapter, when she's thinking about the Titan of Braavos, she thought about the story Old Nan told her, and it was that a giant as tall as a mountain, and whenever Braavos stood in danger, he would wake with a fire in his eyes, his rocky limbs grinding and groaning as he waded out into the sea to smash his enemies. The Bravosi feed him on the pink flesh. Okay. Yeah. The Bravosi feed him on the pink flesh of little highborn girls, Nan would end. Yep. And Santa would give a stupid squeak. And she's already disassociating herself from her actual identity as Arya Stark of Winterfell. Mm-hmm. And in her head, she's just thinking that, oh no, I'm just salty, and salty is not highborn. It doesn't matter. He won't eat me.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's what I think the most interesting thing is, that these identities she takes on, she kind of does them at random at first. She sort of just makes them up really quickly, and then there's not a lot attached to them. And as she goes on, I think she gets more elaborate with them, and she kind of plans more ahead and comes up with the backstory more and starts to lose herself more in them. And then she even kind of goes back to some of her past identities when she tries to pull them up and, you know, adds a bit more into it, which is, I guess partially a survival mechanism to be convincing, for one.
Right.
But it's also easy to get lost in the fiction. Mm-hmm. It distracts you.
If you think about it, isn't that the perfect setup for one of the faceless men? I mean, isn't that exactly what she's supposed to do in that job? So actually, on some level, she's been setting herself up perfectly for this role.
No, but that's probably why Jack and Hagar gave her the coin, because her three wishes were all to kill people or harm them, to do stuff and help other people, really. Mm-hmm. And he would have known that she's already going under an aliases this whole time, which sets her up perfectly. But with all of the aliases, I wonder whether it's not so much acting, but whether she is, I think what I said earlier, disassociating herself from it, and whether she's starting to create separate personalities and has, like, what is it? Dissociative personality disorder?
Yeah,
something like that.
Somewhere in between the two, I think, yeah.
Yeah, because she in her own mind is thinking of herself as those separate individuals, not as this person playing a role.
Mm-hmm. It would make sense for somebody like her to have at least a touch of DID anyway, because of the warging and how they experience
That's a good point.
Thoughts and emotions when they're inside their wolves.
Yeah.
Good point.
It would make sense.
Well, but for her, it's basically just the wolf dreams, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's still a second personality, sort of.
Right, but I mean, like, you know, we all have dreams, and sometimes the dreams feel very real. You wake up, and for that, you know, minute or two afterwards, you feel like you've just done whatever was in the dream, you know?
Yeah.
Nope. Yes, but how often are you a completely different person in your dreams?
Right.
Often.
And thinking of yourself at third party, not as
like
yourself.
An animal eating flesh, not so much.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if we want to talk more about Arya, but one thing I do want to talk about at some point is just all of this info dump we get about Braavos, and particularly the Titan of Braavos, and how interesting it is. And is this really the first time we've really heard, like, a lot of the details of it that we'll later get in the world book and in other places, but still pretty cool, right?
Yeah, question as well. Do you think that the Titan of Braavos, do you think Old Man's story is actually true and that it will come to life?
Yeah.
Or do you think it is just a story? Because her story about the White Walkers and the others all has turned out to be true.
Maybe when magic really comes, it'll... No. There probably won't be anyone in Braavos to prove that, so...
Yeah. I think if anything, Sarah, it'd be some sort of symbolism.
Yeah.
Yeah, or whether there was actually a giant.
Champion.
That would be cool.
Like the stone dragons.
Right, right.
No, ooh, I want to talk about the stone dragons later on when we get to Sam, by the way.
Right.
Okay.
And you know what's interesting is, if you look in all the history, both in this chapter and other places in the books, and even in the world book, we don't really get any sense of how old the Titan is. Like, we know it's old, it's been there a while, but I mean, has it been 50 years, 200, 1,000, 5,000.
Did aliens build it? Probably.
Right. I mean, we don't know. And if you think about it, even logically speaking, I mean,
it's 800 odd years old.
I mean, it's another example of 400. I mean, it's 400 feet tall. Everything George does is exaggerated and huge. But I mean, if you think about, like, that time in our world, how many structures were that tall in our world? They were all pretty much, they were all either like temples or pyramids. Like, we had either, you know, we had some pyramids, we had some religious things in, like, England and a few other places that were that tall, but there was nothing. But meanwhile, this thing exists, and it was built over a waterway. I mean, it's not even, like, realistically possible in their time, you think, to build something 400 feet tall over a waterway. But it's cool, because it's fantasy.
Do you think it was carved from, because it's made out of the same rock it's standing on. Well, do you think there was originally that rock there and they carved it out of that?
The thighs were, or, but the rest of it
was turned to stone by magic.
Right. The thighs
were. It's a real giant.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
A real giant died.
Probably more like Rushmore style. They just cut it over years and years and years and years.
But I mean, I don't think it was originally 400 feet tall. I mean, I feel like the legs were just carved into the mountain and then they like added to the top of it. But how is that even possible over a waterway 400 feet tall? That just seems really, really dangerous.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, it's Colossus of Rhodes, which is what I'm guessing this is based on.
Right.
Is over a waterway, but it's only like 108 feet
exactly.
Tall.
Exactly.
Yeah. George is pretty bad with like measuring things. Like, if you asked him how tall he was, he's like, "Oh, I'm probably like 8 feet tall, right around there, you know, average height."
Yeah. I mean, he even admits that the wall was way bigger than it ever should have logically been, and he does that with everything. But I just thought this was a good example of that kind of thing, of George going, "Yeah, it's fantasy. So if it would be 100 feet tall, let's make it 400. Yeah, sure."
I think he's really bad with measurements, and in his head he's like, oh yeah, it's like this tall, and it's like, oh yeah, that's a couple of hundred feet, and not realizing that vertical meters look so much longer.
Yeah, that's a man's couple hundred feet for sure.
Right, and it's fantasy, so it can be bigger. It's supposed to be bigger. It's okay. And once you've done
I like the wall being so grandiose, but I think as he wrote it and got along, he was like, oh shit, this makes problems for the story.
Right.
Whereas like the Titan being huge doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, it's just cool.
And here's a big question. It roars so loud that the entire city and everything around them hears it. I wonder how that's even possible. Like, what causes the roar?
It's probably from wind rushing through it.
Do you think they can force that, though? Because it happens when there's a ship coming. So how do you force?
Don't they have like a bell or something in it? Right? I thought like they have some sort of horn or.
Not that big of a city.
But
yeah, and it would carry over the water. Really it's loud. Like in a lagoon. Like, sound would carry very well over that.
It would, yeah.
I just want to know something that the whole city could hear under, you know, their technology back then. How is that possible? I'm just curious. Like, it's a neat idea. It's really neat.
This is like another episode of VUK Logistics.
Yes, exactly.
VUK Logistics Miami.
Right.
I'm going to start like some other spinoffs.
We've already got
VOK Finance England.
I just wonder what he was thinking.
He's got a world book handy.
I already read it, actually. I read it after I read this because I was curious, and there isn't a lot of detail about it. So
I say that as I have my world book 2 feet next to me.
I pulled it out as I took that note of how does the Titan roar. I did pull out the world book and looked it up, and there was no answer.
Because I'm actually curious to see. Well, as you were, I'll look this up.
It's fine. I have mine sitting there, too. So.
What's the next chapter?
Next one's Tyrion 3, so that's when he meets young Griff and John Connington's bear. Right. And, oh my god, I should be better at saying that. It's so similar to my name.
Right, and then we've got, after that, we've got the big Sam chapter where we find out about the baby swap.
Yeah, because he's an idiot. Okay, I'll talk to you about that later.
Right, just, yeah. So.
Xander, do you have any comments about this chapter that you'd like to make while we're waiting for Hannah?
Not too much. Like, this set of chapters is kind of a lot of exposition and straight, like, just, like, setting a lot of things up.
Yeah.
A lot of what you can comment on will definitely be discussed in further episodes.
Right.
So I definitely, I don't have too much.
Yeah. One odd little moment. Have we heard before the language called the common, like the language of Westeros called the common tongue? Is that something we've heard named before? Because it is kind of an odd thing I was thinking about. Like, we're going to call it the common tongue, except the moment you leave our country, it's not the common tongue anymore. So what a kind of like central, like egotistical but thing to call it, right?
It might be like air quotes, the common tongue, but like,
I feel like it has been referenced before.
Probably.
I think it's been referenced in Dany chapters before.
They just made, yeah, you're probably. probably right. It just made me think of it because it was here and it's mentioned a few times how they don't speak it, I do, whatever. And it was just like, just as a thought, it's just such an egotistical name for something. Like, we are the common tongue and you're the outsiders because you're...
But it's sort of like French or English being spoken so many places was like, it's, you know, kind of unifying in a way. But like, not everyone necessarily speaks it. But then you go to a lot of those countries, you know, colonialism and all that, and they'll speak multiple languages, so...
Right.
Yep. And as well, in Westerosi world, they have the old tongue, which is just the old version that people spoke. So, still really egotistical.
Yeah.
Did you find it, Hannah?
Well, okay, so I was curious to see how tall he made the high tower in Old Town.
That's taller.
Mm. So, well...
Wasn't it? I remember. I Googled all that.
Here it says that it stands 50 feet above the ancient fortress that was its foundation. And then on the next page it says, Jeremy doubled the city's wealth. His son Jason doubled it again and rebuilt the high tower 100 feet taller. So that's only 150 feet, lighthouse in Alexandria was actually like 400 feet. So he's all over the place.
I actually, in this whole discussion, I looked up some of this stuff and it was saying it was like the tallest structure in the seven kingdoms, and it's taller than the wall. So that means it's over 7 feet.
Oh, really?
Tall.
Okay.
Yeah, it's over. Because when I was looking at this, I first looked in the World Book and then I Googled it and went on like Westeros's wiki and all that. And it's, it is the tallest structure in Westeros, not necessarily Essos, but Westeros. And it is over 700 feet tall.
You can buy tickets to eat at the top at the restaurant, you know.
Right, and it's never been. There you go. It's never been proven. It's never been proven, but it's speculated that it's one of the 9 wonders by man, written about by Lomas Longstrider, which we may be talking about in the next chap. So,
gotcha.
Do you have some stuff to add to it, James?
I just thought it was cute that it seemed like she was she had a sliver of imagination left when she had to grab her sword when they were going under the Titan.
Yeah,
she didn't know if he was going to wake up or not. I was like, okay, that, you know, she is a little girl. She's, you know, even though she might be this murderous creature, she is still a little girl, you know? Mm-hmm.
Which is true. And it's nice to see her have flashes of being a young girl again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, why do you think when she was talking about Old Nan and Maester Luwin, she included Sansa and the people that are probably dead? She's never heard that anything came up with Sansa. So why would she just assume, maybe because she figures that Sansa wouldn't be able to live through this world? Or
that's what I would think.
Or maybe she's just written Sansa off because she's never really been close to her. And she, well, to be honest, Arya might think that Sansa's still in the Red Keep, and Arya has no way to get her there anyway. She can't go in to get her or save her if she's inside the Red Keep. She can't do anything about it, so it might just be, it's not worth me worrying about it because I can't do anything to change it anyway.
True. I'm a Sansa fan, so I just have to say we can't write Sansa off.
Of course.
She's got to, you know, she's coming back.
Realistically, though, like, if you were to think of these, like, kids, you know, from the beginning of the books, and you were to go, who's going to be the one that's most going to survive all this horrible crap? You probably wouldn't think of Sansa as one of the big survivors, but look, she has, so good for her.
Because she's not stupid and doesn't make stupid choices, that's why.
Right.
Yeah.
She didn't get that from her father. She learned from her mother, not her father.
Yep. And
she learned from Peter Baelish, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, or later.
As well, I think Sansa's always been a people person as well, so she's more inclined to be able to pick stuff up and read people, which really, really helps her with her situation.
I just have to throw it in, even though we're not going to get into this, but she did mention there are no trees in Braavos.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
We all know where you're going. We all know where you're going.
Yes. Yes.
Just had to say it.
One thing I also thought was a question I wonder what you think of is when the kindly man, you know, puts the fake face on with the worm and the skull, what do you think is going on there? Do you think that's magic? Do you think it's brainwashing? Do you think it's a fake face?
Do you think that's his real face?
You think so? What do you all think?
It might be because we don't know how long they can live, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we know they change faces. So is that his real face? And he's just pretty much a walking body? But glamours it up with the fake faces. Mm-hmm. And then so he drops that, and then that's his real face.
But what about the worm
I didn't
then?
Think about that.
Because the worm disappears,
well, depending
though.
Depending on how old he is. Or maybe Arya did eat it.
Right. Oh, but maybe she does and she didn't know. Ooh, I like that idea. She really did eat it. It was all glamour.
I thought that the skull on his face was just kind of like a glamour.
Right. But maybe it's the other way around. I like that idea.
Yeah. Did you get a little, like, labyrinth with the whole worm eating, like, right there? She starts to trip out.
Just a worm.
But yeah. No, actually, it made me think back to earlier on with her story, because she was eating bugs with Gendry and Hot Pie and stuff to try to survive. So I'm like, yeah, that's why she goes to eat it, because she's like, yeah, it's just a worm. Cool, like, food, it. Yum.
Was she actually hungry, or was she showing off? I'm not scared of anything. I'll eat your worm.
The reason I wrote in the recap she smells the smells of home is because she doesn't ever say it's like smells of home, but they basically are like pine and stew. And she's like, good smells those. And like, I wonder, is that like when you walk in there, you smell like
what you want to?
What do you want to? Yeah, kind of. Or like, do you see what you want to see? Is there some sort of like opium mist?
Do you think it smells like what comforts you most?
There you go.
Yeah, like something like that.
I would think
and then it's
so.
Magic.
I would think you would smell what your vision of home is. Like, whatever smell it is that is most comfortable to you and you feel the most safe in, that is what you would smell. And that's why she smells essentially Winterfell.
So can you glamour the sense of smell?
Maybe. It's magic. Who knows? Of course, then again comes the question of, would you want them to feel comfortable at home when the whole point is we want you to be no one? Maybe for the clients.
For the
clients.
Faceless men.
Right,
for
the dead. For the people who are
going to
die.
The clients that are going there, and it's meant to be mercy in them dying. Right. So I think it's possibly more merciful for them to feel comfortable.
As soon as you walk in. Like some sort of like scopolamine or something in the air is what I was thinking. Like, no, dead serious. Like, is there some sort of mind altering drug that's like smoked into the air so that you just get this? Or is it actually magic?
Or maybe he
or
does
do you think
it
they're actually cooking stuff because they do need to feed the faceless men? Or do they? Or at least
they just
maybe not.
Pine is comforting to everyone, so they're like, "Yeah, go. Let's do some pine,
even
some lavender."
There's no trees.
I know. I would say for the people around there, that wouldn't be comforting. They don't even know what pine is.
exactly.
There you go. Danny in Dorne confirmed, because there's no fucking place where they get the damn pine.
Yep.
But no, with the lemon tree, they could have always gotten, if it's about the soil, they could have always brought soil from Dorne or something and took it there.
Right. When you're a rich
and then grown it in a pot.
When you're a rich cheese
trader,
you can.
Gardens are a thing that exists.
Right. If you're a rich cheese trader, you might have gardens.
But we're not meant to be talking about Danny.
I know.
But going back to the trees, how are they making, you know, they could make a ship in a day, but they have no trees. Where are they getting this wood from?
That's a good point.
Do you think they don't have any trees because they turn it all into ships?
Or maybe they just pull them from the other side of the mountains there or whatever, you know, the other side of the...
More than likely, and they probably import it.
Yeah, it's a good, like, trading port, so maybe it's just they, you know, all of their stuff coming in is wood, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to think about
these things.
They
might import in wood too.
We're not supposed to think about these things, but we're nerds.
Well,
so
they're lucky
of course
they don't
do.
Need to import in fresh water.
Well, if we didn't have 8 years to think about these things, it wouldn't be a problem, but we've got too long.
Exactly. Well, and maybe several more to come.
Oh, God. Don't say that.
Well, we get at least one, so.
Ooh, by the way, I want to talk about the weirwood door and how it has, there's a face carved into the door of the House of Black and White.
Right.
Out of weirwood, right?
Right.
Okay.
That's it. That I noted
three
too.
Three doors that have faces carved into them in this series. So that's the Black Gate under the Night Fort, the Moon Door in the Eerie, and this one.
On a totally different continent. Cool?
True. Yeah.
Yes.
And it seems, at least with the, you know, two of the doors, it seems like they possess some kind of magic ability, because when she, you know, just said Valar Morghulis, the door opened. I don't know if there was someone on the other end opening it, but it just seemed like it might have like magic qualities.
I know.
And more importantly,
I like the magic theory. Mm-hmm. And is yours about magic, David?
Well, sort
because
of.
I want to talk about...
Yeah, sort of. What I was going to say is, does that mean that Bran can see through the eyes? And
that's
the
what I wanted to
okay,
say.
Okay, I beat you.
That would be awesome.
So Bran is watching Arya, but that's the only tree there, so he has to look through the front door.
Because it has the weirwood face.
Right.
So I'm like, and she says that she feels like something's watching her when she's mm-hmm. standing in front of it.
Exactly.
So I'm like, can Blood Raven see through it? Is that what we're getting?
We need the Blood Raven. Blood Raven.
I did that.
I know. We need it.
I don't think so though, because
why not?
It's all about like the root network, isn't it? And that's a cut tree. Because can't he not see into the places where they've been chopped down?
Well,
that because it's not there anymore?
Exactly.
But this one still has the actual weird wood. And it has a face on it, whereas I think all of the other ones are just dumps and they don't have a face there anymore, isn't it?
Okay, weren't the ones that were chopped down burned? I mean, because then he's definitely not going to be able to see through those. But
does that mean you think that the roots like go all the way throughout Westeros, which is how they can see through the root system?
Well, I mean, I don't fucking know how that works, right. But I'm saying like his throne, he's like entangled in the roots and aren't they like growing in him and shit? So that's what I always thought.
Who knows? I mean, let's face it.
It was more about like the live weirwoods.
Do we think, I don't even know if George has given this much thought
is
to
it
the details.
That it's, sorry. Because is it that it's just weirwood is growing into him, not weirwood roots? In which case, if it's just weirwood, it might be fine that it's being carved and is no longer attached to anything. You know what it reminds me of? You know Narnia?
Mm-hmm.
In The Magician and his nephew, and all of the ways to get into Narnia are actually from a specific tree. So you have to go through that tree to get into Narnia. Yeah. So do you think
but
it's like that?
It's not just trees, though. It's the puddles, too, in that book.
Yeah.
Oh, well, the puddles are before. Like, the puddles are kind of another thing.
And a drop in knowledge. Come on. Do we really think that George has given detailed thought to how the little implications of magic work? I mean, realistically, it probably is. The magic is going to do whatever George's plot needs it to do, and that'll be fine.
obviously, some of it he's worked out, but yeah.
Some, but not in great detail.
Like, not in depth. He's not limited himself that way, I don't think.
Like, I think if he wants that tree to see Arya, the door to see Arya, that door is going to see Arya.
Yeah, because he's clever, because he hasn't ridden himself into a corner with anything.
Well, okay, we're moving on.
Okay. Yes, please. So next up we have Tyrion 3, and this chapter takes place on the 1st of March as well, so the same day as the last one, and it's half a month after we last saw Tyrion, which was on the 15th of February, so take it away, Xander.
Okay, so we start off with Tyrion waking up alone in Illyrio's litter. Outside, the Magister and two men are talking. As much of this chapter is, there's a lot of really good exposition, but it's much too much to do in a summary. Regardless, these two men are Haldin the Half-Maester and Raleigh Duckfield, two members of the Shy Maid's crew. Illyrio leaves gifts for the boy and then the rest of the party. Tyrion and the three men ride out on horses whilst they all introduce themselves to each other. Tyrion admires the Valyrian road, and then they arrive at the Little Roine, which Tyrion comments about it being smaller and slower than the river's trident. Coming to their destination, the three men are hailed. Tyrion notices a boy on the roof near 16 years old waving to them. The shy maid, a small pole vault painted a gray-brown motley, was sitting there. Coming to the boat, Tyrion gets eyes on the rest of the crew and notices that there is an oldish Roynish couple, a handsome Septa, and Griff, a troublesome grizzled old man with blue hair and red roots. Disgruntled by the sight of Tyrion, Griff brusquely asks who he is. Haldin answers that he comes with a letter by Illyrio. Learning Tyrion killed Tywin, he asks what he could offer her grace, speaking of Daenerys. Tyrion replies that he's killed those in her way to the Iron Throne ascension. Griff asks why a Lannister would join a Targaryen, given their history. Tyrion replies that he would do it for gold, glory, oh, and hate. Tyrion thinks Griff is a poor life form. Tyrion thinks Griff is a poor liar from their conversation and sarcastically calls both Griff and himself by their fake names, Huger Hill and Griff, and then he ends up calling him, where is it? Sorry about this. Calls them by their fake names. Tyrion asks Griff, what if they find Daenerys dragons are no more than just tales, such as snarks, grumpkins, ghouls, and winged lions. Griff takes this poorly, calling him Lannister, and then again warns it is no game they are playing. And that is the end of the chapter.
Thank you, Xander. Do you have anything that you'd like to talk about with this one?
Other than stumbling a little, trying to read my own handwriting, this, like the last chapter, it's just a lot of exposition that, like, is really great to talk about, but will come up in later episodes where it is the focus of the conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the biggest things from this chapter that I like to bring up is when Illyrio, you know, he has a bunch of chests for the crew of the Shy Maid. Tyrion notes that Sir Duck raises one of them over his shoulder and it can't be coins because it's too heavy.
Right.
And Illyrio remarks that, oh, it's just, you know, fancy clothing for, like, the boy and everybody else in the party, blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that I think, and I know this is an old thing, but I'm very partial to it. Do you think that one of the gifts in the chest is the Blackfyre sword for young Aegon?
Ooh. Ooh. I like it.
Ooh.
I like it.
Well, they do say that they're giving armor in
the
chests as well as court clothes. So it makes sense, because if they're giving him armor, they might also be giving him a weapon. So that sounds super cool.
I like it.
Would be better than Blackfyre?
I think Blackfyre is definitely going to show up at some point, and I mean, that's as likely as anything.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. And do we know who was in possession of Blackfyre before?
Not most recently.
Oh, we went over this not that long ago, but I mean, it went across the sea and it kind of got lost, right?
Which would be Inessos.
Wasn't it with the Golden Company?
Yeah, because
what's his name? Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, if it's with the Golden
Company, we have no idea.
So Bittersteel took Blackfyre with him in exile to the Free Cities, where he eventually founded the Selsor Golden Company. Aegor refused to give the Valyrian sword to Daemon the Second Blackfyre in the failed Second Blackfyre Rebellion. The sword's current whereabouts are unknown. So it could be, because there is the theory that Illyrio and Varys, but at least Illyrio, are with the Blackfyres. I don't think that's actually a theory, but there's that one, which would make sense, because if they are Targaryens, or I shouldn't say Targaryens, but you know what I mean?
Sort
if
of. They are bastard Targaryens. They bastard might Targaryens.
Yeah.
They're bastard
or
Targaryens.
It might be with the Golden Company still, but it's hidden somewhere there, in which case it'd come up later.
Well,
or it might be in that chest.
Right. I like the chess thing, although if it was with the Golden Company, it would make sense that they were heading towards Dany in that area, because that's kind of the area where the Golden Company are, so maybe. But
yeah, and because, as well, it's these guys that meet up with the Golden Company too, isn't it? Oh, wait,
right.
No. Yeah, it is these guys. So it makes sense, because if they don't have Blackfyre, the Golden Company might, and they might pick it up there.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting.
I like it, Xander. I like it.
I do. One interesting thing, I think, reading these two chapters in a row, even though they're, you know, in two different books written years apart, is how we get so much world building in both of these chapters. And I think in both cases, a part of it is because not much actually happens. Although in Sam's case, particularly, well, actually Sam's later. So what I'm saying, in both these cases, they're really set up. So I think that's why he takes the time to throw in that world building he likes, because I mean, you know, we had all the world building around the Titan and Braavos and all that. And now we're getting a lot of little hints. I mean, we get some of the stuff around the Dance of the Dragons. We get talk of Rhaenyra's she-dragon Syrax and all sorts of other stuff. Lomas Longstrider. We get so much world building in both Westeros and Essos in this chapter. And I wonder how much of that is because, let's face it, Tyrion doesn't have a lot to do, so we're kind of stalling. I don't know. But either way, but or also, if it's just George having excitement and this is the stuff he wants to talk about, so let's do it.
I think so. And it's also possibly because he's not getting edited down and he's not controlling himself. And he's like, oh yeah, I'll just like write however much of this chapter about this stuff from history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't know.
You didn't
know,
see my side eye, but I did a side eye, and I'm like, eh, George.
Right.
But in saying that, I really enjoy it, mm-hmm. but it's more like, this is why your books are so big, man.
Right. But I mean, you could tell he was really dying to tell, like, the story of the Dance of the Dragons and that stuff, and he's trying to fit it in where he can, and then eventually he gets to do the world book where he ends up going off for, like, hundreds of pages that end up becoming two novellas and a new spinoff book and all that. So, like, he really wants to tell this story, you can tell, right?
Yeah. And with this, Beena actually has a comment about the world building in this chapter. And she says that Tyrion remains observant and smart here. And she also says that we get the lovely backstory about Uncle Jirion, but she hates seeing him start to revel in his reputation. Mm-hmm. And even thinking about selling Jaime out.
Right.
And she believes that Tyrion still loves Jaime.
Right. I mean, he even says, I'm going to kill him next. You know, well, him and Cersei next, so.
Tyrion said the last time he saw him at the end of a Storm of Swords, didn't he say, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you?
Right.
So.
Yes.
So, yeah, he's says just it again. Keeping
right.
with that. Yeah. So it's mm-hmm. not overly strange to hear that again,
mm-hmm.
especially because it is so soon after.
Yeah,
that happened.
One of the things I really liked in here was a little bit when he starts to talk a little bit about the Lomas Longstrider and when they walk across the Valyrian Road, that's one of the nine wonders made by man, and how he mentions that he's actually living his childhood dream of traveling the world and seeing these wonders that he read about in the books, but didn't quite go the way he hoped it would go. Yeah. It's a nice little irony there that he's getting his dream, but be careful what you wish for.
The way that George wrote it with at the very end of the Grumpkin, Snarks, Ghouls, and Ghosts mm-hmm. line, he did, you know, winged pigs, .. winged lions. Like, I think that, you know, Tyrion probably somehow knows that Griff is who Griff is, but how would he know that just based off of, you know, the way that he carries himself and the fact that he can read? And, like, I just don't understand how intuitive he is to know that.
Because he knows who John Connington is.
Mm. I don't feel like he knows. But I feel like that was more foreshadowing for us than Tyrion.
But he knows. I think he might know something's up with mm-hmm. Illyrio and who they're going to see. I think it's more he knows that something's happening, right. but not necessarily what is right. happening.
Which even the first time you read, you kind of get that sense. Something's going on. But I mean, I had no clue what was going on here. But you could tell there's something up here, you know.
This chapter and a lot of this I didn't put into my summary because it was just way too much exposition to like try to fit in it. But I think that Tyrion very much understands what's going on. He may not know who young Griff is, but he has an idea that he's something special. But Griff, he figures out almost immediately. He's like, yes, this is a lord of Westeros. And then after talking to him a little bit, he realizes that he's the exiled lord of Griffin's Roost, you know? Like, and that's why he even makes the comments about, like, the snarks, grumpkins, and winged lions.
Right, okay.
Maybe.
Yes, because a griffin is a winged lion.
Right.
Right.
Maybe. I wonder if...
But... Yeah. No, just as well with that chapter, it actually just reminds me of Bran's first chapter and how every time something weird's happening, they're like, oh, Grumple Snarks. And all of this other stuff that they just pass off if it's magical. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but how much of it's actually real? Everything. Everything is what I
maybe
think.
Maybe, yeah. Speaking of magical, sort of, did you notice a little mention of Grayscale with a little foreshadowing of what's going to happen with the Stone Men and Shireen?
And yes, that's something else I wanted to bring up.
Just Tyrion, it's something that fears him. The Grey Shroud kissing him, so getting Grayscale is something he's really scared of. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And again, more things that I wanted to bring up, but will be more substantial conversations for when it actually comes up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, even more, just more foreshadowing for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
And of course, we get more mentions of how shitty a father Tywin was. Every time he thinks back, like, to his past and his history, Tywin was just being a total prick to him. It's like, what an awful life.
You know, honestly, it sounds more like
gold.
Tyrion, you're grounded. You're not going out. Look at what you did. Your girlfriend is not up to scratch, but apart from, you know, it's actually his wife. But that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Just a bit, but way harsher and not actually something you'd want to see in real life. But yeah, I just think that's funny that it sounds like Tywin's just grounding him. And oh, by the way, what do you guys think about Uncle Geryon, that's probably how you say it, Uncle Geryon, and how he'd once Tyrion had memorized all of the wonders of the world, Uncle Geryon used to put him on tables at feasts and have him recite them all. What do you guys think about that?
I like it as nice backstory, but I also feel like it's a bit heavy-handed for George to go back. Like, the whole front flipping off of the stables in Winterfell, it's kind of him just going back to, like, figure out a way, like, the same way that
not make that so ridiculous.
Yeah. Right. The same way he thinks about the memory with his Uncle Geryon, like reciting all the Nine Wonders. He also, is it later in this book or earlier in this book where he like thinks about like almost the same exact situation where he's like tumbling on top of the tables instead of just reciting things. So I think it's partially like nice little cute backstory to help build characters, but at the same time, kind of small retcons.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
To the character.
Because it's certainly not nicer to be like, hey, look at how smart our kid is. He can, you know, he can name all these wonders and tell us all about them as opposed to let him do little flips.
But the thing is, though, Uncle Geryon's also the one who taught him to do flips, like you were saying. But is Uncle Geryon teaching him to be a fool and to make people laugh and to be a comedian and more like Patchface and Moon Boy? Or is it, hey, I'm super proud of you. I want you to show other people. Is Uncle Geryon taking the mickey out of Tyrion and Tyrion just didn't realize it because he thinks Uncle Geryon's one of the few people that cares about him and respects him? Or what? Because, I don't know.
What was that turn of phrase you just used? Taking the mickey out of him?
Yeah, you never heard that?
Yeah, as in making fun of him, pointing fun at.
No, I've heard it so many times, that's why I'm asking.
No. I mean, at least in Tyrion's mind, it was sincere. Like, look at this kid and his knowledge. He's smart. It sounds like it. Now, whether Tyrion's remembering that correctly isn't clear. You know, I kind of like Xander's idea that this is a retcon.
Kid at that stage, too.
Right, so he may not remember. But still, normally when you show off a kid, like, look at what this kid knows. Look what he can tell. Like, that's actually kind of a cool thing. I mean, whether or not this is a, you know, rosy memory that wasn't accurate, because we have lots of unreliable narrator issues in these books. But I like the idea that, and even if it is a retcon in George's mind, I actually really kind of like that idea that he's trying to be like, no, look, he was saying how smart I am and how educated I am.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, James.
Oh, I was just going to say, I feel like it could be his uncle's way of, like, giving him a place in court, you know, if he could be the knowledgeable guy or even the guy who can do flips, at least he's going to be present, because then you know he's not going to be a fighter or a knight or someone who's going to be in a high place of power. So it might just be his uncle's way of, like, okay, I like this guy, we got to keep him around, so I'm going to give him a set of skills that might make him valuable to other people.
Mm-hmm. Which is very true, yeah.
And that's absolutely what I would think. I think his uncle, Jerian, was more so like, just like, I love you, you're a Lannister, you're my nephew, like, this is awesome, let's show these people what you can do.
Right.
But,
I hope so.
But
I
the
hope.
Reason the reason it's so hard for us to, like, kind of see that is because pretty much we only have his siblings and his father to go off of. I think the best character around that we can get a better look at it is Jenna Lannister. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't even necessarily put Tyrion on a pedestal the same way his uncles would, but still kind of mentions how he is very, very much a Lannister, and he is very much talented, you know? So I would think where is the uncles we don't have, they genuinely were proud of their nephew Tyrion, regardless of his disabilities, but all we have are his dad and his siblings, and we really only have the one sibling that actually likes him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For someone who claims that Tyrion's his favorite character, can George go even, like, one chapter without mentioning the Tyrion waddles? just one chapter. It's brought up in every single day, like, and he waddled by. It's like, you know?
Well, you know, George is a big guy. He might be partial to a waddle.
Maybe.
He likes a waddle.
I just, every time I notice it, it's like, do you really have to say this all the time? Like, we got it. We got it. He's short, he waddles. We got it. Can we move on?
Oh, I love him.
And of course, we do get yet another Where Do Whores Go reference, because that's all we're getting for the next long time.
So speaking of Jerian, am I the only one that thinks that he didn't disappear, but that Tywin killed him?
Because Jerian was also more fun-loving and did stupid things, or not stupid,
well,
but
because,
like, flips
well, because
and stuff?
He also had, like, a bastard daughter with, like, a whore or something. And just, like, the embarrassment
did
to
he?
The family.
I don't remember that.
Jamie mentions it at one point. Her name's... It's Hill something.
Because in this chapter, Tyrion is remarking...
It's Joy Hill, isn't it?
Yeah, Joy Hill. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I didn't know that. Because in this chapter, when Tyrion is 15, about to turn 16, he's talking about how he wants to, you know, do a tour of the free cities like his uncles did. And Tywin remarks that he won't, because he could have trusted his brothers to not bring shame to the name because they didn't marry a whore. Like, something along those lines is what he said to Tyrion. And then that's when he gave him charge of the drains in Casterly Rock.
The sewers,
it might not have been a whore, but it was definitely not like a lady or anything. Like, his daughter was like a bastard.
See, sure. That's weird, because I don't remember that. Oh, man, I gotta look that up.
Jamie says something about it. I think it's like in Storm or something. But I just, because even without that, I mean, Jerian's just so different, and he was like one of the favorites of their dad and stuff. It just seems like a Tywin thing to do, to be like, because supposedly he never comes home, and then Tywin sends men out to find him, and they trace his progress back to Volantis, and then, you know, then he disappeared. And I just always thought it was like...
Yeah, and as well, supposedly half of Jiren's crew left him because he was planning to sail into the Smoking Sea.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine enough story. It could be true, but it just makes me... I wouldn't put it past Tywin, that's all. And I don't think that it's of any importance by any means, but it's just another feather in, like, the evil megalomaniac control freak cap of Tywin that I could totally see happening.
Yep.
Yeah.
Isn't there a theory that Jerian is the Shrouded Lord?
that one. Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Hmm. No, I for sure have seen that. Yeah.
Jiren being the Shrouded Lord. That would be so interesting because we have Jiren and the Shrouded Lord both mentioned in this chapter.
Hmm.
And Tyrion's being like, oh yeah, no, I'm so scared of it. I don't want Grayscale. And right. If it is his uncle that he loves, that'd be super cool.
See, I'm more of the mindset, even if we'll never learn it, that Jiren did eventually go to Valyria, and he found Brightroar, and he found a Valyrian suit of armor,
there you go.
And Euron
killed him, took his things, there you go.
And he is going to show up with Brightroar in his Valyrian armor at some point in Winds.
See, and I feel more like he never made it out of Old Town, just his ship did.
Mm.
Like, I wouldn't put it past...
Or whether they killed him on the way and just tossed his body overboard, because you can't prove it then.
Right. Very true.
And if it's a Lannister crew, they'd be loyal to Tywin more than Jiren. Yeah. Because as well, I really, like, I wouldn't put it past Tywin, because he's all about family legacy, and, like, even the name of Jiren's ship was the Laughing Lion.
Yeah.
That was the name of his ship. I cannot see Tywin being okay with that.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, but Tywin is all about family, so it's more like, would he do it? Or would he just threaten to do it?
He absolutely would, I think.
His wife did, basically, too.
Yeah.
And Jiren becomes their dad's favorite, and then, you just see a lot of resentment there, like a repeating pattern of resentment with Tywin.
It's always fun listening to theories forming on the fly.
do you guys think that Tywin dislikes Tyrion so much because of his more silly aspects then? Not just being a dwarf. Because like, this is what my father was like, this is what my father enjoyed, I don't want to be my father. And so he's very against that and doesn't want his children to be anything like that.
All of the above.
With Tywin, it's all the above.
Yeah, I think his biggest issue is onefold, that he is a dwarf and is just silly and an asshole. But I think the biggest issue Tywin has is that he killed Joanna.
Exactly.
When he was born, because she died in childbirth.
But the thing is, it's like, this is my problem with Cersei and sort of Tywin too, if that's why he hates Tyrion. It's more like, that is not his fault.
Yeah, but that it's not his fault.
And if you guys can't get over it,
Joanna, it's not only did he, like, kill her, and that's how he looks at it, but also, he's not even worthy enough then
to have he's been not worth dying.
You know, he's.
Like, if Jaime had come out of Joanna and killed her, at least, like, this would have been worthy, you know? She gave birth to a, you know, great warrior and all that, but at the same time...
He wouldn't have been ever affectionate to the child. I don't think he ever really is with his kids anyway.
Right.
But I don't think that he would have actively rooted against him or tried to...
But hate is rarely logical. Remember, though, hate is rarely logical. So we can say would he have... I mean... He's found a million reasons to hate Tyrion, and then you can also get into the whole theory of, you know, is it not even his? And regardless of any of those, they all compound in his head and into this whole, like, Tyrion is the epitome of everything he hates. You know, he took his wife, the one joy in his life, whether it's his fault or not doesn't really matter. You know, whether or not there was any dalliances with the Mad King, just it's a reminder of it, even if it's not even if people think it or question it, that's a reminder. You know, he's a dwarf, which, you know, is huge. It makes him look bad or whatever he wants to think. And it's all of that stuff just compounding into a big mess of hate that's never going to be logical, and it doesn't matter, because once you hate, you hate.
Yeah, very true, David.
But and he's all pride, so, you know, anything that knocks his pride at all, he's going to hate. And in every single one of those ways, Tyrion knocks his pride down.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But. Very, very true. Do we want to talk about the letter that Illyrio sent for John Connington? John Connington. Jesus, I can't say his name. Right. For John Connington. About Tyrion. Do you think that what John is actually telling Tyrion is all that's in it? Or do you think he's lying about it? Because John burns it straight after he reads it.
Right.
So he can be lying about it.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's definitely has to be more in the letter.
Yeah, no, I think he's so definitely lying about it.
I think, I don't know.
Yeah, like, I think there must be a lot more in that letter, which is because Tyrion asks to read it. And if it's just about Tyrion, it'd be like, oh, yeah, here you go, rather than burning it straight away.
Yeah.
I think Tyrion and Connington are immediately playing their own personal game of Savas.
They are. They are, though, because they're both trying, I guess, they're both trying to one-up each other a little bit.
And especially because they each have, like, a little bit of information on each other just because of the kind of people they both are. But they're literally just trying to play off each other. You see it as they go down the ruin, how apparent it is that these two can totally see each other because they're both, members of very high-ranking members of Westeros families and everything that like that. So they're able to see through all the ploys and everything they're going to do throughout the next chapters. So I definitely think there was more to that letter that John Connington was like, yeah, no, I am not giving you anything other than you already know.
I can agree with that. You never in the letter. It could have said that. Oh, I packed the Valyrian steel sword with it. So
yeah, I put Blackfyre in there. So yeah. Don't tell Tyrion.
Yeah, make sure nobody knows.
Just between us, and burn this right away before he gets a chance to read it.
Right, it was like a Mission Impossible type message. Like had self destruct on it. You know, exactly. Self destruct after reading.
We get all the usual Tyrion bits in one chapter. We've got, you know, we've got a little bit of history. We get mentions of what an asshole his father was and how he treated him. We get a Where Do Whores Go reference. It's like, check the boxes the waddling reference.
Yeah.
And the waddling.
But the Where Do Whores Go reference was perfectly placed within, the context of the conversation that he was having.
Right, it did fit.
It really was. No, and that's why I think, like, this chapter is probably one of the better Tyrion chapters in this book, because you do get all the typical Tyrion marks that you would expect in a Tyrion chapter, but there's so much exposition and backstory that, like, is really important but doesn't play off for at least couple hundred pages or more, including just like the introduction to Haldan the Half-Maester and Raleigh Duckfield, the whole conversation. I swear, if I could have, I would have just made my summary the conversation between the three of them, because it's amazing. The Half-Maester gets so irritated with Tyrion and his smarts and wits and like sarcastic assholery that he's just like, oh, Duck, it seems like you're fond of the imp, so I'm going to ride ahead. You can carry him on your own horse, whatever. And then he doesn't even catch up with him till like a quarter of a mile later. Like, it's just the whole interaction with the three of them is really, really awesome.
Yeah.
Because you get nice backstory, you get nice exposition, and you get a nice setup so that when you do finally get onto the Shy Maid after this chapter, you feel like you understand half of these people, and you learn the whole dynamic of it, that it really does build a good intrigue. And I know, like, I'm not a huge Tyrion fan, but I do like his chapters. I do think the Shy Maid chapters are some of the best chapters ever. Like, they're They're really good. They really build up what is going to happen while giving you that still weird fantasy horror shit that George loves to write.
Yeah, I think this is a good example of kind of like a loosely written chapter that worked. But then, of course, you have in Feast, like, the Nimble Dick chapter, which was just, like, hard to get through. And it's like, you know, they both have, like, world building. They both have, you know, backstories of people that aren't necessarily that important. But at least this one, I feel like it's easier to read this. I'm more mm-hmm. invested in these characters rather than reading through a Brienne chapter where she's just aimlessly wandering.
Don't badmouth my girl, Brienne.
I will agree that this is more exciting. But at the same time, I honestly love Brienne's chapters in Feast. Like, I love Feast as a whole. One of the best things to do is when reading Brienne, think about Don Quixote. She's just doing a Don Quixote story.
Right. I will say, though, I like the way that George did manage to get his world building in there with this whole little, like, well, let me quiz you. What do you know? Do you know about this? Do you know about, like, the mask going back and forth? It makes for a neat way that it kind of furthers the current plot while still letting us throw some fun world building in there. I like that.
It makes it fun.
And with that world building, it's all, like, dragon info here. It's such a dragon nerd, by the way.
Right. Is this the first mention in the books of a she-dragon, by the way? Because I know there's a specific mention that Rhaenyra had a she-dragon named Syrax, and that's the whole discussion they have. And I don't know if there were other mentions, but it's always interesting because it previously or in other times it seems like they're saying that they are one gender, and then they say that they can switch, and it's sort of like we're going back and forth. And in the world book, they try to kind of play it like, well, we're not sure.
The dragon rider is female, so it's a she-dragon. But I always thought, same as you, that, you know, dragons are kind of like intersex or whatever. You know, they don't really have a gender.
Right. But there are, like, several, because I Googled this myself, and there's several, like, mentions of specific she-dragons. There's, like, four of them that are specifically always mentioned as she, while other people think, and I think there's, like, a debate among the maesters, and since they're dead, there's no way to prove it now, now that's not the case with Dany's, but, you know, so there was debate, like, were they, weren't they? And I'm wondering if that was because George changed his mind, or because he messed up, or is he deliberately keeping it vague for reasons that may become important to the plot later.
Probably deliberately keeping it vague, but it could always be that dragon prefers to be a female rather than a male. So it might just be dragon personality. But actually, Tyrion's dream, when we first come upon him in this chapter, he's just woken up and he said he has a dream, but he can't remember what it's about. Do you think it's a dragon dream? Because we know that he has had dragon dreams previously.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Especially as he's getting closer to them.
because he is getting closer. It's the right time, but he was too drunk and didn't remember it. Because there's so much stuff about dragons in this chapter.
I'm going with confirmed. Confirmed.
It's canon. We know.
I don't think it's confirmed, but I think it's like, it might have been.
If Sarah says it, it's confirmed.
Yeah, if Sarah said it, it's confirmed. It's your authority here.
Well, in that
here.
Case, there are so many weird, random, crazy theories that are confirmed. Like, all of them.
And that's a bad thing. Why?
Because I'm pretty sure a lot of them aren't canon.
I know. So
more than likely. So now we finished with Tyrion 3. We're going to move on to Sam 2. And this chapter takes place on the 2nd of March. Yes, so the 2nd of March, and Jock wrote the summary, but David's reading it, okay?
So,
Sam... Thanks, David.
Oh, it's okay. So, Sam has a battle with seasickness aboard the ship Blackbird, which sets sail from Eastwatch, and he thinks of how everyone is going to have a happy ending, save him. Gilly will be a maid in his father's house, Aemon will retire, and Daron will take Yoren's place as a recruiter far from the wall. But Sam does not want to be a maester or see his father. Gilly is as miserable as Sam and ignores his attempt to cheer her, and the baby is frequently sick. A happy ending in Westeros seems to be becoming the maid of a brutal misogynist. After 10 days, Blackbird strikes east for the island of Skagos, whose inhabitants were rumored to be ruthless cannibals. Daron makes a mocking comment about Gilly, saying, saying he thought wildling women were supposed to be brave, and Sam insists she is, just that she's frightened of the sea. It begins to rain, and Amon stays on deck until Sam finally carries him below. He and Gilly are trying to warm the old man when the whole ship heaves, and the storm doesn't let up for days. And the rain feels good up against my face, Sam. It feels like tears. Let me stay a while longer. I pray you. It has been a long time since I last wept. Amon tells Sam that Gilly's tears are not fear, but grief for her child. Sam doesn't understand until he realizes what Amon is saying, that John has switched Dala's and Mance's baby for Gilly's to keep the wildling prince from Melisandre. Sam is horrified and sickened and goes up on deck. Daron joins him and opines that perhaps the worst of the storm is past. Sam disagrees and points to lightning in the distance. The worst isn't done. The worst is just beginning, and there are no happy endings. Sam gets it.
Thank you. That was so well written, guys, and read. Great job.
Thanks.
So good sad. Job, Chuck, and good job.
In any case, that's a bummer, right? We're so happy and having fun, and now we get to, like, one of the darkest chapters in the book.
Oh, it totally is.
You know, I mean, you can be the biggest John apologist out there, and I can be at times, but, I mean, how do you justify that? It's just awful. I mean,
I get it, but right. Still.
I mean, can you justify it? Is it for the greater good? I don't even know. I mean, it's messed up. I mean, Gilly, you know.
The thing is, I can understand why he did it. And if after they've left and he knows they've gotten out of thingy, he tells the people and is just like, guess what? But
he's gone.
He's still separating a mother and child. And Gilly's baby is only 3 months old.
Right.
And they'll probably never be reunited ever.
Right. I mean, we can hope.
It's not like he sent both of them away, which would be preferable, like so much better.
Right.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have been able to keep up that ruse. I mean, I agree with it in the sense that doing what he did, one of them has a chance to survive, hopefully both. But if he had done nothing, one would have for sure been killed.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
Yeah.
Couldn't they? But even then, couldn't you have, like, smuggled the other baby in a basket somewhere and had Gilly take her own baby? I mean, I don't think anyone has a problem with the smuggling Dala's and Mance's baby out. It's, but taking, I mean, he basically just took Gilly's baby from her, and potentially that baby's about to be killed. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, but that's got to be what Gilly's thinking. I mean, here, not only am I never going to see my baby again, but it's not like my baby's going to a better place. Like Dala's is, my baby might be killed and even worse, burned to death. I mean, it's just awful, and I can't justify it. I mean,
well, and not even that. I mean, like, most new mothers are so concerned with, you know, providing their child with, you know, the proper amount of milk or and everything like that, and she leaves thinking that this child's going to be drinking goat's milk and starving. You know, it's like, I don't know. I think it's. I don't want to rag on John or anything, but I just think it's really messed up.
Yeah.
I think he was too concerned with, I think, the bigger picture rather than, hey, what's better for everyone involved.
Or even more, he was too concerned about Mance, but didn't give a crap about Gilly and her baby. I mean, right? Isn't that really what happened here? I mean, and now it Sam, is, who's his best friend, like, it's fucked.
No, I mean, with Gilly's kid as well, no one's actually really going to be taking proper care of them, and they are going to be messed up. I'm sorry, but because the first 2 years of life is where you develop all of your attachments, and based on that is how you interact with other people going forward, and they are probably going to have, I forget the name of it, it starts with D.
Reactive attachment disorder?
I think so. Sorry, I'm just Googling it because I forget. resistant attachment. Is it resistant? No, I don't think it is. It starts
reactive attachment disorder. I knew a child that had that, actually. She was adopted.
Yeah. Yeah, because that normally happens if children are neglected, which they probably will be, and abused, but I think they're going to be neglected, definitely.
I mean, I think he's banking on the fact that they're not just, like, random spree murderers. There's a reason for what they're doing. I'm not justifying it, but they have a purpose in their burnings, and it's for King's blood. So he's probably banking on the fact that once they're safely away, if they go to do anything to that baby, then he's going to be like, wrong baby, kids. And then they won't. They're not just out of vengeance going to slaughter some rando baby. That's not their bag. But also, he doesn't know, so there is that argument. I mean, that's kind of a...
But even in... But that's the best-case scenario, and even under that scenario, he's taking a baby from a woman against her will.
Right.
Against her will. I mean, it's not like he went to Gilly and said, hey, I got a deal, will you do this with me? And she reluctantly agreed. Like, did she have any choice in this matter? I can't imagine. And even if... I mean... What options this I mean, Gilly's like already going to be pretty developmentally disabled, having grown up in the scenario she did, and now she has no options in the world that are good for her. And and now you've taken her baby from her. Like it's messed up. I mean,
and being that this is a reread, we know that, you know, she didn't really have any intentions of actually burning Mance. So like rereading it is more frustrating because you know she wasn't going to do that to Mance's child anyways.
Yeah.
So it's just it's more, you know, it builds to the frustration. And I don't want to back Tanya up too much, but I'm not a John lover. So
I kind of am.
The level of Tanya, but I'm definitely not a John lover.
I generally am, and I can't justify this. It's awful.
Yeah.
But it's shocking and cold of him, and it's to me it's out of character for him.
Right. I mean,
and I think that's the saddest part of it is Sam's realization of what Maester Aemon is saying. Like when Maester Aemon says whatever threats she was under, whatever threats the Lord Commander made, you know, like he won't even refer to John by his name anymore. And letting that sink in with Sam, it's tragic.
And even worse,
the thing is, I feel so bad for Sam because Sam's also blaming himself for putting John in that position, where it's not Sam's fault; it is John's fault. He made that decision unilaterally.
But if Sam hadn't made him commander,
ask anyone.
But if Sam hadn't helped make him commander, then he would, or Lord Commander, then he would not have been able to have done this to Gilly and to the baby. And indirectly, it is his fault,
both would have been dead probably anyway.
Dead already, because they would have been turned away from the wall away.
That's a good point. But he's not thinking that now. He's thinking, this is my fault.
And so Dala's baby, you know?
Right.
I mean,
it's
just a screwed situation, no matter how you want to slice it.
Yep. But the thing is, Sam had been so hopeful earlier in this chapter and was thinking they're all going towards a better life. And then he finds that out and he's like, we're all going towards such a horrible place.
Right.
I'm like, Well,
I mean, it's heartbreaking at the end when he says something about, you know, the worst is just beginning. There are no happy endings. When at the beginning of the chapter, his entire thing is to, you know, this is his plan. So everyone's going to have a happy ending.
Exactly.
He's he's the guy that's going to come and solve everything. And it just, you know, he kind of just got completely shut down on that.
Right. He's like, I'm going to save the day.
For everyone, this is turning out to be a horrible trip.
Right.
Because Aemon dies.
Exactly.
Daron turns on them, gets killed. Gilly and Dala's baby.
Right. It's like all around bad.
On a lighter note, I think it was funny. I thought it was funny when Sam said, I have a queasy belly, and Tyrion said, with a belly as big as yours, Slayer, that's a lot of queas.
Yeah.
I just thought
that was a good one. I made note of it, but again, it's like, that's just like, you know, the Tyrion waddling. It's like, okay, again, we got the fat guy, and we're making jokes about him fat and his big belly. It's like, okay, we get it. You don't have to beat us over the head with this. He's fat. We got it.
Yeah, Sam's the bear.
Oh, by the way, I also think Sam's a fucking idiot for not being able to tell that they're two different kids, because babies are not identical. Yes, some of them look like potatoes and look kind of similar, but you can tell, and they are from different parents, and they probably look very different, because...
Yeah. Yeah, but Dala how much has of a very look different... has he ever gotten at that kid if it's constantly swaddled for being in the frozen tundra?
Right. I mean, he's also a man in medieval times. They're probably not spending a lot of time snuggling with the baby and paying attention. So he may have never even gotten a good look at the baby, you know?
Well, and I agree with what Sarah was saying, but there's a part in the chapter where it seems like he tries to look at the baby and Gilly kind of shies him away from that. And she you know, pulls him away. So I don't think he's ever actually really had a chance to hold the child or anything like that. So I don't know if he's...
baby.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, the only time he would have really gotten a good look at the face of it being exposed to the cold would probably be while it was breastfeeding, and he wouldn't be staring at it while it was breastfeeding. That's not a Sam thing, I don't think.
It's not. Yeah.
Well, and I also felt bad, I mean, just for Gilly having to think that she has to clean that up when the baby was having diarrhea on the furs. I just know that my dogs have had diarrhea on, you know, on things that are, look like fur, and that is hell to get that out. So I feel bad for Gilly having to clean that up.
And to clean someone else's baby's diarrhea.
Oh, God, yeah.
Not even her baby. Like, at least it's your dog, your baby. You know, it's one thing. This isn't even hers, and she's got to.
Yeah.
Here's a question I have, though. Do you think that John really did want Sam to be a maester, or was that just the excuse to get Gilly and Mance's baby and Amon out of there?
I think it was a way to kill two birds with one stone. He knows that he has to get Amon out of there. He knows that he has to get Gilly and the baby out of there. And then why not just get out, you know, the plus that Sam is going to become a maester one day. So I think it was just kind of like a trifecta of chance kind of thing.
Yeah, but they could have. He could have always just sent to the Citadel for
a new maester
to be sent up because it means they don't have Sam there for probably an extended period of time, which is stupid because he knows more about everything else than anyone else who is there at the moment. And because that is a very long training period of years.
Right.
You're saying that you're not going to have a maester for that long a period?
Right.
It's ridiculous. Right.
That's why I was wondering.
Incredibly silly.
Yeah, I think more so the fact that he knew that he had to get Amon out of there, he knew that he had to get the child out of there, and then, you know, who better to do it but than the one person that he trusts the most, Sam?
Yeah, I can see sending Sam to do that. I can see that, and I understand it, especially if he's getting Gilly to go and work in Sam's parents' house, it makes sense to send Sam.
But isn't it shitty not to tell him that's your plan? Like, hey, that's the shitty part of it.
It's shitty to send him off on a years-long mission. I mean, he's not going to come back for years and years,
And the thing is, you supposedly trust Sam with everything, which is why you're sending him on this mission, yet you don't trust him to tell him, hey.
Exactly.
Like, so you know this is what's actually happening. Don't tell anyone, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that could have been George's way of just getting us 214 chapters into, you know, or pages into it before dropping that bomb.
Maybe, yeah.
It may have not been a John decision, more of a George decision.
That's somewhat valid, yeah. But, you know, I do think, you know, Sam looking at Amon and thinking, oh, you're going to have a nice, happy retirement in Old Town among your peers. It is so sad. You know, it's like, oh. And then, and then Amon mentioning Dunk again. Like, oh, remember Dunk escorting him to the wall and having those memories there? It's like...
By the way, I have a theory about his amnesia. Okay, So it's actually after they pass Skagos that Maester Amon starts to lose his memory. And that's... He gets rained on that night and then he leaves. Okay. So my theory with Maester Amon is that so he starts to lose his memory right after they've passed Skagos, after he's rained on all night that time. So I just thought I saw a lizard outside. I didn't. So with it, and that night he says he hasn't cried in ages, which is why he wants to stay out in the rain. Do you think that Bloodraven has been keeping Amon senile and a hip young maester more than the wall? Because it'd still be cold there and he's staying outside on the deck the whole time. So do you think it's more his proximity to Bloodraven more than the temperature that's keeping him senile?
That makes sense to me now that you've said it. I never thought of it, but now that you said it, it seems right. Because, I mean, I don't know. I work in healthcare. I don't know how temperature would have anything to do with senility, you know, or, you know, with a person's capacity to remember. So that may seem accurate.
Yeah, because they're traveling along the same, line at least at that point. Sorry, yes, Jock?
Maybe. It's the other way around, like, free of any ailments.
Sorry, so what do you think is keeping him free?
He says the other way around, but I don't
know. Maybe it's the opposite. It's the wall that's been keeping him some requiring any of the costs of old age.
That's what I was
Which
thinking,
is
actually.
Possible, but I guess, have we seen any people with dementia or anything like that at the wall? I don't think most of them make it to that age, though.
Right, exactly. They don't live that long.
Yeah, I don't think, yeah.
But that is a neat idea. Maybe it's the wall and or Bloodraven that actually kept him from going, you know, getting dementia and getting senile and whatever. And that, in fact, once he gets away from it, that ironically, sending him away may be what did him in. Maybe Bloodraven was keeping him around, and that, in fact, he had another horrible mistake that John makes in this chapter. Or, you know, has made.
Because Bloodraven got sent north to the wall with Aemon.
Right.
And they are obviously close, so I don't think it would be that hard to believe that he's keeping Aemon alive, because Aemon was 35 when he was sent to the wall, and then Sam was talking to Aemon in this chapter, and he said it was 100 years ago that he was sent to the wall. Mm-hmm. So that means he'd be about 135 or around that. That's old. And for the time period, it's insane.
Now's the appropriate time to say it's all Bloodraven.
Yes. I don't know. Because I also thought that it might have been because it's on Westeros, and once he left Westeros because passing Skagos going. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he's not like he's one of the first men. It's he's a Valyrian, so it shouldn't matter that he's leaving Westeros.
Right.
Since they're originally from Essos, so.
Yeah, so if anything, he should be getting better going towards Essos.
And Aemon has the one line in his dreaming waking up. He's like, Egg, I dreamed that I was old.
Aww. Oh, yeah.
Which is why I think it's Bloodraven, because if Bloodraven's been in his head the whole time and then he's lost contact, it's a sudden reverse back to it, possibly.
Like he thought that was the dream, or I don't know.
Yeah. Or do you think Bloodraven's been in his head controlling him this whole time? Oh my god. Probably.
Ooh. Confirmed! Confirmed!
And that's why he's suddenly like, oh my god, I dreamed I was old. And then he's actually been...
Oh, crap.
With dementia this whole time, but he hasn't been in control of his body. And
Oh my god, it was like he was a host for Bloodraven.
Uh-oh. Confirmed!
Tinfoil. I love
Confirmed.
It.
It's massive tinfoil. But... Yeah.
What is but a Sarah podcast it's for? It's not a proper podcast without at least some tinfoil, let's be honest.
I like tinfoil. No, I really like the fan theories, so.
Oh yeah. Even the ones that we know are ridiculous are fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Right, it's nice to hold us over till we get actual answers.
Yes.
then you better be working on a whole lot more theories.
Well, I do have another one for this episode.
Oh, here we go. Let's do it.
So my next theory is about Skagos. So Skagos, oh my god. Skagos actually means stone in the old tongue. Mm-hmm. So what I was thinking is the stone dragon could be on the Skagos as well. By the way, every time I hear stone dragon, I'm just thinking, the great stone dragon from Mulan. So it might actually be on Skagos as well, because if that actually means stone, it makes sense for it to be there. And with it, maybe that's also why the Skagosi have always been very isolated from everyone else, and they haven't really acclimatized into the north or migrated and don't have strong ties with other houses in the north, because they are very insulated to try to protect that secret.
There we go. And maybe what we'll actually get is Rickon riding a stone dragon while John rides an ice dragon and Danny rides a regular dragon. Maybe that'll be our big finale. We'll have like all the different kinds of dragons confirmed.
That'd be fantastic. I have a question. Do you guys actually believe that the Skagosi are cannibals? Or because personally, I think it's more them perpetuating a stereotype and creating one.
That's what it feels like.
Because if they send someone out to say, oh yeah, we're cannibals, that's one way to keep people away from coming in. Because they say that the island next to Skagos that supposedly in ancient days they sent people to and killed all of the men there and feasted on their flesh for 2 weeks after that and took their women.
Right.
Whether that's just a story so that people don't come to Skagos to keep right. them away.
Could be.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think they're all cannibals. I think that it is like a horror story to keep people from going there.
Right.
Or
maybe it's an excuse. They died of, you know, something. They got eaten by sharks or something happened and, hey, let's blame it on cannibals. It's, you know, could be one of those just weird legends that came up.
Yeah.
But then again, if all the legends are there to keep you away, wouldn't the unicorns make you want to go? It's the opposite. You know, I want to go to see the unicorns.
Right.
Like, that's exactly. not a bad thing. I want to see the unicorns.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say, getting back to the stone dragon thing, what I was thinking is because, from what I understand, I think Melisandre is supposed to raise, you know, or wake the stone dragon. And what I was thinking is if Jon is a Targaryen and he is dead at the end of the last book, would bringing him back be technically, you know, dead as a stone?
Right.
Bringing
stone
him
dragon.
Back, you know, would she be waking the stone
dragon. And if he's, like, frozen solid, so it's, like, stone, like, really hard, yeah. like a stone, stone cold.
Yeah. In almost,
rigor mortis,
you know,
rigor mortis.
The metaphorical, yeah, yeah, exactly, rigor mortis, like the metaphorical dragon of being, you know, a Targaryen
right,
as
yep.
a dragon.
Oh, yeah, we get
or a Targaryen, yeah, who can, you know,
get it.
Ride.
Yeah, and, like, there's always the Shireen one because House Baratheon is descended from Targaryens anyway, and she has grayscale, so part stone.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with Tyrion's stuff in the future, he's got, like, and John Connington, which is the grayscale, too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of options. So, George, get on it. Give us a book, please.
So we're thinking about this way too much.
I know. One other little yes. note, though, since we like to find parallels between these chapters, we just had Tyrion and his awful past and his awful father, and we do get a nice little awful story about Sam and Randall Tarly, where he threw Sam into a pond to learn how to swim, and he, like, couldn't do it forever, and he couldn't breathe, and then hated it, and then also someone else in the family comparing him to a pig, so he forbidded him from eating apples forever after
oh,
that.
Oh, red wine,
red wine.
Because he was going to be a cupbearer for, I think, Paxter red wine,
right.
But because he was really bad at swordsmanship and wasn't a competent fighter, mm-hmm. That was ended, and he was also meant to marry the red wine's daughter, but mm-hmm. yeah.
But it's like, so just another parallel of awful fathers and... You know, and just more, oh, these poor kids, how did they survive these awful family lives?
But I also think it must have been the time period, too, because it's more like, breed them strong.
Right.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's very a Randall Tarly thing from what we see later, you know, him being very tough and rough and... You know, not exactly the epitome of compassion, let's just say.
Yeah, their sigil is a huntsman, so, I mean, they're meant just to be...
yeah.
To be brute men.
Yeah. By the way,
never lasted
speaking
in that family.
Of...
Right.
No way. And speaking of huntsmen, when Sam was positive and thinking about what the baby was going to be at Horn Hill when he grew up, he was thought huntsman as one of the options, so I think that's funny, because I was like, ha-ha. Your house sigil, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, you could argue that was a little subtle. Maybe he'll think he'll be in my family, kind of.
Yes. Yeah. So, thank you everyone for listening. The next episode will cover the events from March 7th to the 12th, and that's Arya 2 from Feast, which is where we get a Faceless Man training montage from her, Jon 4 from Dance, and that's where Jon tells Stannis to win over the Mountain Clans and to take Deepwood Motte, and Davos 3, my boy Davos, from Dance as well, and he's going to the Manderlys Court. And you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, and WordPress by searching for Vessels of Kingsgrave. And if you'd like to get involved, you can join us on the forum. So that's a podcast of Ice and Fire forums. And does anyone have any upcoming episodes?
I would just say keep your eye out for the Sense8 finale. They just announced the air date today June 8th.
Cool.
We will be doing that as soon as we can after it comes out. So if you haven't watched Sense8 yet, watch it because it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then go listen to our podcast about it.
And then join you for the final episode.
Mm-hmm. Join us.
Goodbye, everyone. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Sarah. Bye,
thank
everyone.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.